Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the conference call on positive data from the part one of MOXIe trial of omaveloxolone for Friedreich's ataxia. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a Q&A session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance at any time, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. A PDF version of the presentation is available now on the webcast. It will also be available along with an audio recording of today's webcast on Reata's website, reatapharma.com, in the Investors News section shortly after the call today. Before the company proceeds with its remarks, please note the forward-looking statements disclosure in the company's press release. The company will be making forward-looking statements on today's call. There are many factors that could cause results to differ from expectations, including those noted in the company's SEC filings. Today's statements are not guarantees of future outcomes. Please also note that any comments made on today's call will speak only as of today, June 2nd, 2017, and may no longer be accurate at the time of any webcast replay or transcript rereading. Following the prepared remarks, we will open the call for questions, and we ask you that you please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up so that we can accommodate as many questions as possible. I would now like to introduce the conference over to Vinnie Jindal, Vice President of Strategy. Sir, you may begin.
Hello and welcome to Reata's conference call to discuss the results of part one of our MOXIe trial for omaveloxolone in the treatment of Friedreich's ataxia. I'm joined today by Reata's CEO, Warren Huff, and our Chief Medical Officer, Colin Meyer, and I'll now turn it over to Warren.
Thanks, Vinny, and thanks to those of you dialing in to hear the program update on MOXIe. As many of you know, Friedreich's ataxia is a severe, progressive, neurodegenerative disease that limits the abilities and lifespan of patients with the disease. Currently, there are no approved therapies for patients with FA. Several years ago, it became clear to researchers in the FA community that suppression of NRF2, the target of Reata's omaveloxolone, played a central role in the pathogenesis of FA. As a result of that insight, the preeminent patient advocacy group in FA, the Friedreich's Ataxia Research Alliance, or FARA, approached Reata and encouraged us to study OMAV in FA given its potential to increase the activity of NRF2. In 2014, Reata began a two-part trial called MOXIe in patients with FA to determine if OMAV could induce NRF2 in FA patients and if restoration of NRF2 would translate into measurable clinical improvements. Because MOXIe was one of the first studies of OMAV in humans, and we had not conducted a formal healthy volunteer phase one study of the drug, we designed MOXIe as a two-part study. Part one of MOXIe was a phase 1-2A design in which we serially dosed the drug from a very low dose of 5 milligrams across seven dose levels to a maximum dose of 300 milligrams. At each dose level, we randomized only 6 patients to active drug and 2 patients to placebo, primarily as safety controls. We gave ourselves the option to add up to 6 additional active patients at doses where we saw promising pharmacodynamic activity to get better resolution on our treatment effect. Since we did not know the active dose range or have any clinical efficacy data when we started the study, we did not expect or power the study to show significant results in a clinical parameter with a small n at each dose level. We did, however, hope to identify a dose level that consistently activated our target NRF2, improved markers of mitochondrial function, improved neurologic function or exercise capacity, and, of course, was safe and well-tolerated. We're delighted today to report that Part 1 of MOXIe met all of those goals. As Dr. Lynch's presentation earlier indicated, we saw clear dose-dependent induction of NRF2 and markers of improved mitochondrial function that were optimal at the 80 and 160 milligram dose levels. These pharmacodynamic markers correlated with improvements in neurologic function as evidenced by improvements in the patient's modified Friedreich's ataxia rating scale scores that were optimal at the 80 and 160 milligram dose levels. The treatment effect at these active dose levels are not subtle or ambiguous. There was an improvement in neurologic function that separated from both baseline and placebo and represented a recovery of approximately 2 years of decline in function after only 12 weeks of treatment on OMAV. These changes represent highly clinically meaningful improvements in these patients, which we believe have not been observed in prior studies. Further, despite the very low N of only 12 active patients at the 160 milligram dose level, the group showed a highly significant improvement from baseline and a strong statistical trend of significance with a p-value of 0.06 versus placebo. We also saw promising evidence of improvements in peak work when we accounted for patients with a foot deformity called pes cavus that made it difficult for this subset of patients to perform the test. Part 1 of MOXIE is one of, if not the largest, phase 2 study performed in FA patients and provided us with clear data on dose and clinical effects of OMAV in these patients. Because of the robust results, we're planning to begin part 2 of MOXIE during the second half of this year, and we're looking forward to working with FARA and the FA community to conduct the study. So with those opening remarks, I'll turn it over to Colin to discuss the data in greater depth.
Thank you, Warren. As Warren mentioned, FA is a progressive and life-shortening neuromuscular condition. It's caused by hypoexpression of a protein called frataxin. In patients, FA typically presents with loss of coordination and difficulty walking. Patients also have significant fatigue and often develop metabolic disturbances. Unfortunately, there are no approved treatments for these patients. These patients are followed often by their neurologist using an exam called the Friedreich's Ataxia Rating Scale that measures the severity of the disease. There are five sections of the neurological component of FARS that include measures of bulbar reflexes, including speech and swallowing, upright stability, upper limb coordination, lower limb coordination, and peripheral nervous system function. FARA, the patient advocacy group, in working with FDA, decided to omit the peripheral nervous system from the FARS exam to create the modified FARS or MFARS so that all of these assessments are functional in nature. And this has been studied extensively in FARA's natural history study. They've now enrolled over 1,000 patients, and some patients have been followed for up to 15 years. In a recent publication from 2016, in a cohort of 821 patients, they demonstrated that patients gain, on average, 1 to 2 points a year. And so the annual loss of function equates to 1 to 2 points. Importantly, the change in this scale highly correlates with changes in disease stage and activities of daily living. We've characterized our class of compounds, including omaveloxolone and its related molecules, across numerous preclinical models. There are approximately 350 peer-reviewed publications, and we have observed a very characteristic pattern of regulation. Importantly, omaveloxolone induces NRF2 in cultured muscle cells as well as FA cells. We often use target genes of NRF2, such as NQO1, shown on this slide. Furthermore, omaveloxolone improves mitochondrial function, as shown by ATP levels in the bottom left of this slide and the transmembrane potential from patient samples with FA on the bottom right side. We see a very clear dose response across a very large range of concentrations that then becomes maximal in plateaus and is followed by a decline. We see this with NRF2 target genes as well as function. Most importantly, you can see in ATP levels that the levels are maximal and then they decline and there's complete loss. This is important because in our clinical trial, we wanted to identify the dose range that was associated with clear activation of NRF2 and maximal improvement of markers of metabolic and mitochondrial function. NRF2 is a transcription factor, and it increases the antioxidant capacity of the cell to lower oxidative stress. In FA, there's too much oxidative stress. Importantly, if there's too much induction of NRF2, that can create reductive stress, and that can be just as bad as oxidative stress. And so the cell has multiple mechanisms to make sure that NRF2 is not too highly induced, and that is why we observe this very characteristic pattern of regulation. So MOXIE, as Warren mentioned, was designed as a two-part trial. The first part of the trial was designed to assess activity and safety across a broad range of doses. The second part of the trial that I'll discuss at the end of this call is designed to confirm efficacy and safety. Part 1 was like a dose escalation trial done in other settings, but it was placebo-controlled to make sure that we could formally assess safety. It was randomized, double-blind, and dose-ranging. Importantly, it was multi-institutional and international. It enrolled 69 total patients, randomized 3-to-1 to active drug OMAV or placebo, and we ended up enrolling patients across 7 dose levels. In total, there were 12 weeks of treatment, and the safety of the trial was overseen by an independent data safety monitoring board. As Warren mentioned, this trial was not powered to show statistical separation versus placebo at a given dose level. The trial was designed to assess a broad range of endpoints to look for dose-dependent induction of the target, NRF2, as well as markers of mitochondrial function to determine if those associated with clinical activity in one of potentially several endpoints. We assessed the muscular exercise activity as the primary endpoint, and so that was done during exercise testing. Peak workload was the primary endpoint. The secondary endpoint was a neurological assessment called modified FARS I discussed previously. We also conducted the timed 25-foot walk test. Overall, OMAV was well tolerated, and there was only a single patient who discontinued due to a rash at a low dose, 40 milligrams, and there was also one placebo patient who discontinued. And overall, the baseline characteristics were generally balanced across the treatment groups. When assessing markers of NRF2 induction, we saw clear dose-dependent activity. It became robust and significant at 80 milligrams and was maximal or near maximal at 160 milligrams. Doses of 80 milligrams and higher was statistically significant from baseline. We also measured two key measures of energy metabolism mitochondrial function, including AST and CK. In animals that lack NRF2, AST levels are suppressed, as AST is important in promoting substrate availability for the electron transport chain for it to produce ATP or energy within the cell. AST showed significant increases at 80 and 160 milligrams that were maximal at 160 milligrams. And similar to the in vitro data, at the high dose, there was less activity of AST. CK showed dose-dependent induction or modulation through 160 milligrams, and the 80 and 160 milligram dose levels showed significant separation from placebo, from baseline. Next slide, please. Changes in pharmacodynamic activity were associated with improvements in efficacy. Across the placebo patients, there was a slight reduction or improvement in modified FARS of 1.4 points. That change was not significant from baseline. Across all doses of omaviloxolone, there was a 2.5 point improvement in modified FARS that was very significant from baseline. Overall, the placebo-corrected change was 1.1 points. Across the individual dose levels, we saw dose-dependent and linear increases from 10 through 20, 40, 80, and 160 milligrams, with 80 and 160 milligrams showing significant separation from baseline. Notably, at 160 milligrams, which is the dose that showed the most robust induction of NRF2 target genes and modulation of energy metabolism parameters, we noted a 3.8 point improvement in modified FARS with a very low p-value from baseline. And while the trial was not powered to show statistical separation from placebo, with only 12 active patients and 17 placebo patients, the change of 2.3 points was almost significant. And this change of 2.3 points represents approximately 1 year of progression for these patients. In looking at the data, we were very careful to look at baseline characteristics and disease characteristics that could affect response to treatment. And we noted that patients who have a foot deformity called pes cavus, which is associated with a high arch foot and loss of lateral support of their feet, can respond differently to the drug. In patients who had pes cavus, there was less of a response, but in those who did not have pes cavus, there was a greater response. When we look across all doses, the change improved from 2.5 points to 3.3 points, so the placebo-corrected change improved from 1.1 to 1.7 points. And focusing on the two dose levels that showed the most robust pharmacodynamic activity and activity in modified FARS overall, these dose levels also demonstrate the most robust activity, with a 4.2 separation at 80 milligrams and 6-point separation at 160. It was very significant from baseline. Notably, the placebo-corrected change in this subset at 160 milligrams was statistically significant with a 4.4-point improvement. The exercise testing did not demonstrate any separation from placebo across all patients. During conduct of the clinical trial, we received reports from multiple clinical sites that patients with the foot deformity had a difficult time doing the test, and they reported they could not reach peak exhaustion, which was required in order to determine peak workload, because of pain associated with pedaling because of their foot deformity. When we examined the data in patients who did not have pescavus, we saw that overall, across the drug-treated patients, there was a significant change from baseline and a 4.3-watt improvement over placebo that was not significant. The effect appeared dose-dependent, with the most robust change being demonstrated at 160 milligrams, which also demonstrated the most robust change in modified FARS. From an adverse event and safety perspective, the AEs were generally mild in severity. The primary imbalance in the drug-treated patients was upper respiratory tract infections. While the change was numerically higher, it was not dose-dependent. The infections were normally mild and resolved, and there were no atypical infections. In looking at data with our other molecule, bardoxymethyl, we have not noted any signal for increases in upper respiratory tract infections. Also, we note that the excess incidence of transaminase increases were not associated with any signs of liver injury. Importantly, are regulated pharmacological effects of the drug. There were only two serious adverse events, and importantly, these were only in placebo patients. There were no serious adverse events in drug-treated patients. So in summary of the data, we believe that the trial was successful in meeting the objectives that we laid out upon initiation. Number one, the drug clearly induced NRF2, which is suppressed in FA patients. We saw robust, statistically significant induction at 860 milligrams. Furthermore, markers of pharmacodynamic parameters, including energy metabolism, mitochondrial function, were significant and most robust at 80 to 160 milligrams. This translated to improvements in peak work that were overall modest, but appeared meaningful in patients without pescavus at 160 milligrams. Changes in modified FARS showed the most robust improvements also at 80 to 160 milligrams. The adverse event profile was acceptable across the dose range, and the Data Safety Monitoring Committee did not raise any safety concerns during conduct of the trial. And lastly, there was only a single discontinuation, and overall the drug was well tolerated. So based upon the learnings from the first part of the trial, we've constructed a design for the second part of the trial to confirm efficacy and safety. It's very similar to the first part of the trial, except for we've made a few adjustments. First, we've changed the order of the endpoints so that modified FARS will be the primary endpoint, and the secondary endpoint will be peak work. We'll also characterize a broad set of exploratory endpoints. The dose that we've chosen is 150 milligrams, which is very similar in exposure to 160 milligrams, and allows for patients who have difficulty swallowing to take one less pill per day. And we'll randomize 100 patients total evenly between drug and placebo. And importantly, we'll stratify by the presence of the foot deformity. Patients must have baseline modified FARS scores between 20 to 80, and the two values during screening before randomization must be within 4.5 points. It's an important design element to help limit variability and improve the sensitivity of the trial. And of course, patients must be able to complete the exercise testing. Overall, we've extended the duration of treatment from 12 weeks to 24 weeks. Once again, the size is 100 patients, and we're limiting the number of patients with a foot deformity to 20 total. Because of the design elements of the trial and the variability that we expect, we anticipate observing a treatment effect of approximately 3.5 to 4 points based upon data from the first part of the trial. But because of the size of the trial, we should be able to detect a treatment difference of 1.2 points. And so we believe that this is a very well-designed trial that we plan to initiate in the second half of this year.
Warren? Thanks, Colin. Before taking questions, I want to briefly thank the patient families, our investigators, and FARA for enabling MOXIe to be run and to succeed. In particular, FARA's depth of expertise has been invaluable for the design and execution of MOXIe, and we look forward to continuing to work with the FA patient community as we advance OMAV into pivotal testing. Operator, you can open up the line to questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then the one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. We ask that you please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up so that we can accommodate as many questions as possible. Our first question comes from the line of Matt Kaplan from Ladenburg Thalmann. Your line is now open.
Hey, guys. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. Well, congrats on the initial results. Could you help us understand in terms of the pharmacodynamic results that you got in terms of the biomarkers that you're looking for induction of NRF2 and how they correlate with the clinical endpoints that you measured, in particular mFARS and the peak workload, and especially commenting on the 300 milligram dose?
I guess, Matt, I guess as context, we've conducted, obviously, numerous trials with bardoxolamethyl, the related molecule. This was one of our first trials with omaviloxolone. With bardoxolone, we consistently follow ferritin and GGT as well as AST and CK, and we see these very characteristic changes. And typically with bardoxolamethyl in PAH as well as in our renal programs, we see about a 50% induction of ferritin and GGT at the active dose range, as well as increases in AST of a similar magnitude to what we saw in our FA patients at 80 and 160 milligrams, and reductions in CK of a similar magnitude that associate with clinical activity. And so in this trial, our first goal was to demonstrate that omaviloxolone had biological activity in these patients. And it took us a little bit longer to identify the dose range than we initially planned, but we identified a dose range that was clearly associated with induction of NRF2 targets that hit the magnitude that we saw clinical activity with bardoxolone. The changes in AST and CK were also very similar to what we saw with bardoxolone. Modified FARS score, of course, which we have not studied previously, is specific to these FA patients, and we saw changes in the modified FARS that mirrored the changes in particular AST. And so we saw some slight induction, interestingly, at the lowest dose at 5 milligrams. It wasn't significant, but it was actually 3 of the 6 active patients. And we actually saw some clinical activity at that lowest dose. We're not sure if that's because those patients had some inherent sensitivity to the drug, but nevertheless, the two mirrored each other. But the results were most robust at 80 and 160 milligrams. And then, as you mentioned, there was a loss of activity at 300 milligrams. This is consistent, once again, the modified FARS change with the AST change. It's consistent with the changes that we've seen in vitro. And it's consistent with what we've seen with actually bardoxolamethyl and other molecules in preclinical models. If you simply do a search from Google for NRF2 and U-shape response, you'll find numerous peer-reviewed publications demonstrating with a lot of primarily natural product activators of NRF2 that there's this characteristic dose response. Now, we've seen in preclinical models these changes. We've seen them in renal models and pH models preclinically. We've seen them especially with many topical models where we can administer high concentrations. So for us, it wasn't unexpected. We haven't seen it with bardoxolamethyl in patients because we've studied in a very narrow range. Here, this was our first trial really to study omaviloxolone. As you notice, we studied a very broad range of doses. Most trials, you see a 2- to 3-fold range in doses. This was a 60-fold range in doses, and so eventually we did hit that dose where we saw a loss of activity. And so we think the data are consistent with what we hypothesized and with what we'd see. And once again, the modified FARS does mirror the changes in the objective PD markers.
And then and correlating with that, can you just comment on the other endpoints that were measured in terms of clinical endpoints beyond the mFARS and the peak workload?
So the other major endpoints are timed 25-foot walk test, which was highlighted in the presentation. this is a quite variable measurement. Some patients take a few seconds to finish this assessment, which is really no different than a healthy volunteer. Others take 100 plus seconds, and so it has a lot of variability. But importantly, it shows directionally that the change is associated with changes in mFARS, and so they move together. And so those were the major efficacy variables that showed the clear signals that we'll be studying. Of course, we've added some additional endpoints to the second part of the trial, including the activities of daily living. We think this will be important to characterize the effect of the drug. As mentioned earlier in the presentations today by Dave Lynch and some of the FARA members, that's a very insensitive measure, and it would require hundreds of patients, if not thousands, to be able to show a difference, but we thought it would be important to characterize it. Interestingly, in the AE profile, there were fewer patients on omaveloxolone who reported falls. It's about 2% of drug-treated patients versus 12% of placebo-treated patients. And so we're going to determine if that is a potentially a real effect by collecting falls in a fall diary in the second part of the trial. And so those are the major points.
Okay. Thanks a lot for taking my questions.
And our next question comes from the line of Adam Walsh from Stifel. Your line is now open.
Hi, guys. Thanks a lot for taking my questions here. My first one is, based on today's patient and caregiver testimony at the FDA patient-focused drug development day, it seems that cardiomyopathy is reasonably prevalent in Friedreich's ataxia. What percentage of FA patients actually have cardiomyopathy? And then kind of as part of that question, I believe Dr. Lynch mentioned that cardiomyopathy will likely be an exclusion criteria in part two of MOXIE. And so how do you expect to eventually access those patients? Thanks.
Yeah, so excellent set of questions. So yes, cardiomyopathy is common in FA patients. I think approximately a third of patients ultimately die because of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And it happens towards, often towards the end, of their disease, or if they present, very early in their disease or in their lifetime and are rapidly progressing. Most clinical trials exclude these patients because, they are on the severe end of the spectrum and can inject, variability into the trial. And so we simply followed the recommendations of the KOLs, including Dr. Lynch, to exclude these. And so it was not often a reason for screen failure in our trial, and so we don't expect it will inhibit enrollment. And we would expect that in future trials after the second part of the study that we would potentially study these patients.
Great. And then my second question is, at the end of your press release, there was some discussion about some communication that you had with the FDA surrounding the potential for the agency to ask for some indication, some endpoint related to activities of daily living. And in a competitor's presentation at the patient-focused drug development day today, they also seem to be waiting for FDA confirmation around what an acceptable or an approvable endpoint would be. Can you just expand upon that a little bit and where you are in terms of understanding what the agency will want at this point?
Yeah, this is Warren. We got very clear guidance from the FDA when we designed MOXIE. We actually had been focused, as you can see from the design, on the peak work initially because we had data on walk distances and mitochondrial function around the pharmacology and did not have any clinical data yet in a neurologic indication. And they responded and literally requested us to do the modified FARS. And Adam, as you may know from the background of the meeting today, the modified FARS was worked out between FARA and a number of the key opinion leaders with the neurology products division of the FDA to exclude certain aspects of the broad FARS, particularly those viewed by the FDA as just neurologic signs. So the modified FARS was actually developed with input from the FDA, and in our pre-IND interactions, they asked us, requested that we confirm that we were doing the modified FARS in the study. They also indicated that it would be most appropriate to support approval under Subpart H. We got a communication recently that was not in connection with a meeting, and that was, let's call it casual, that suggested that we use the ADL rather than the modified FARS, and we believe that communication was a statement of what would be necessary to, in their view, to support full, not subpart H approval. And we've asked the division to confirm that, and we'll be having some interaction with them about the endpoints of the study. In terms of the design of the study, we're measuring everything, almost everything that we think could be a potential validated endpoint here. And modified FARS is one of the most validated endpoints, as you may have heard from the discussion. You know, they, FARA and the community have performed a large longitudinal study showing very high correlation between the modified FARS, the activities of daily living, and other markers of progression of the disease. So we believe the modified FARS will be acceptable. It's the guidance, formal guidance that we've gotten previously, although we are going to ask the division to confirm that.
That's very helpful. I'll jump back in queue. Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Ritu Baral from Cowen. Your line is now open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the question. As you look at today's data, how should we think about the delta seen versus baseline and versus placebo? In many diseases, KOLs place more importance on a delta versus baseline for sort of real-world benefit versus placebo, and obviously your stats are different in the different comparisons. I see you powered the phase 3 for placebo-controlled differences, but maybe you can speak to KOL opinion on that, and also if you could address the variability that you saw in the MFARS. I believe on slide 8 you show MFARS, but no error bars. Was the variability in the measures as expected?
Is the stats and the variability, and so I'd say that our Dr. Lynch pointed out to me recently, our variability for modified FARS is actually less than what's been seen in other trials. I think in part because our patient population was fairly homogenous. We've noted that in the other trials in the space that have largely failed, they've had a very broad set of eligibility criteria, and so they've had patients, you know, across a broader spectrum of the disease, and they, there's been a less well the job of controlling for variability upon entry. And if you're listening to Jen Farmer talking about the training effect of modified FARS, they've seen that in multiple trials. And so in many other trials, they've enrolled patients who have not seen the physician recently and have only had a single measurement upon entry. You know, we had two measurements upon entry, and most of the patients were routinely seen by their doctors, and therefore the variability was lower. And so as far as the placebo response, that was kind of as expected, if not slightly lower. I think the standard deviation of the change was around 3.5 FARS points. So once again, you know, consistent with what we hoped it would be and lower than other trials, and that's what we've modeled for the second part of the trial. And as far as the significant the changes from baseline, obviously the statistical calculation is different than the change versus placebo. And I think as we've kind of very clearly stated, and as Warren mentioned at the beginning of this call, the trial was not powered to show statistical separation versus placebo. If we would have done that with 7 dose levels, we would have needed hundreds of patients. And you can look at recent precedents such as a Horizons trial that was powered to show difference versus placebo, and it was 90 patients. And so the second part of our trial is powered to show a difference versus placebo, and it's a similar number, approximately 100 total patients. And so we were actually quite happy to see that per the ITT analysis of the modified FARS endpoint, which is the phase 2 dose versus placebo, with only 12 active patients and 17 placebo, that the placebo-corrected change was 2.3 points, which while it may seem like a small number, that represents about a year's worth of progression, so it's very clinically meaningful. And the p-value was 0.06. And so, you know, it was, you know, just missed the classic definition of statistical significance. Then obviously in the subset of patients who did not have PESCAVIS on a post-hoc analysis, the treatment effect was greater, and then the p-value was even smaller. And so, you know, from our perspective, you know, we had, you know, many learnings from this trial, and we hit our objectives of finding, you know, a dose that's biologically active and clinically active and safe, and we incorporate all that information to design what we think is a very conservative, you know, second part of the trial that we hope will confirm efficacy and safety.
A very quick follow-up. In your side effects, did you see any bilirubin changes or any signals of edema?
We saw no changes in bilirubin at all. No changes in bilirubin. And with bardoxymethyl in our larger trials, we've actually seen reductions in bilirubin that have been associated with the transaminase modulation. Yes, yeah, so in the Beacon trial, there are actually half the number of serious adverse events of hepatobiliary SAEs in the bardoxymethyl group versus placebo. And as far as edema and cardiac status, these patients had, you know, very normal levels, you know, of BNP, a marker of fluid retention. It did not change versus placebo or baseline. Furthermore, blood pressure was unchanged, and there were no adverse events associated with any markers of fluid retention.
Great. Thanks for taking all the questions.
And our next question comes from the line of Brian Skorney from Robert Baird. Your line is now
open. Hey, good afternoon, guys. Thanks for taking my questions. Two quick ones. First, just on the inverted U-shaped curve, and I know in the prepared remarks you said that NRF2 can create inductive stress. I guess my question is there any way to specifically measure inductive stress to kind of test the hypothesis around whether at 300 mgs you're truly seeing that effect? Because just other than AST, none of the other markers really indicate any offsetting effect at that dose. It just kind of looks more like it's at the top of the PD dose curve.
Yeah, so I think the first thing to appreciate is that you know, we see this regulation not only with our molecules but with other NRF2 activators, you know, in vitro. And as I was discussing previously, NRF2 has to be regulated within a relatively tight range, specifically because reductive stress, you know, is bad, and that there needs to be, you know, some oxidation, you know, in the endoplasmic reticulum so that proteins can properly fold. When we look at regulation of NRF2 with our molecules at high concentrations, we actually see induction of KEAP1, which is the negative regulator of NRF2, which our drug binds to activate NRF2. And so we see that specific effect, which we believe, you know, explains the loss of activity.
At high doses.
Correct. And then with our data clinically, once again, we saw induction across, you know, a broad range. And so ferritin, we started to see increases that weren't quite significant from baseline at 40, that increased through 300. As Dr. Lynch mentioned, you know, this is actually suppressed in FA patients. That's likely why we did not yet hit a maximal level at 300, whereas GGT is normally within the normal range and no different than healthy volunteers. And it did hit a maximal level at 160, and it was, of course, no different at 300. And AST, once again, was maximal at 160 and less at 300. And so it was an expected effect based upon all the, and the wealth of the in vitro and preclinical data. I think, you know, clinically, how do we test that? I guess we could do, you know, more sophisticated, you know, ex vivo assessments, but there's, you know, plenty of evidence, you know, with our molecules and with other NRF2 activators that, you know, this does occur with this pharmacology when you modulate NRF2.
It's just most important to know the dose.
Right, and then can you just walk us through the dose escalation? These were sequential cohorts, right? This wasn't all in parallel, and how was the decision made to expand from what looks like 6 per cohort to 12 for the 160 mg dose?
So this was, it was guidance that was specifically provided by FDA at our pre-IND meeting. And so they requested that we have a data safety monitoring board to oversee the safety of the trial and dose escalation, and they recommended that we dose escalate until we saturated exposure or maximized the PD effect or hit an MTD. And we had a an exposure cap, you know, included in the protocol based upon preclinical data associated, you know, with preclinical tox margins. And so the DSMB waited until all 8 patients from a cohort reached week 2, and then there was a safety evaluation formally done by the DSMB as specifically requested by FDA, which is very similar to what's usually done for healthy volunteer phase 1 trials. And then if there was a recommendation to proceed, we would then open up the next cohort. And so we allocated within the protocol 9 total cohorts. We could dose escalate a maximum of 100%, once again consistent with standard phase 1 trials. And at every single safety assessment, the DSMB recommended dose escalating to the maximum until we reached the top end per the protocol, which was 300. And at that point, we allocated the 2 remaining cohorts to the 2 highest dose levels.
In parallel, we were looking at the pharmacodynamic markers that were mentioned earlier, and at the 160 milligram dose level, they hit kind of our target thresholds based on our experience with the class, where we thought we would likely see, high level of efficacy. And that's why we expanded that cohort.
Gotcha. And did you do a comparative analysis of those 12 patients with the, I guess it would be 6 patients on the placebo side at the 160 mg dose?
Then there would be 4. But no, we grouped all the placebos.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Our next question comes from the line of Charles Duncan from Piper Jaffray. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Sarah on for Charles. Thanks for taking the question.
Sarah, how are you?
The first one, great. So in addition to the presence of the Pascavis deformity, did you perform any analyses by age or baseline scores or anything else that would inform the Part 2 enrollment?
Yes, we looked at, basically, all data that we had and all baseline characteristics, and the presence of Pascavis, was the primary one that, influenced the data. There was an association between the GAA1 repeat links and Pascavis and modified FARS score in Pascavis, but the presence of Pascavis, was the strongest, and that's why we're largely, leaving the eligibility criteria the same for the second part of the trial, but we're just tightly controlling for the presence of Pascavis by capping those patients who have it and by stratifying.
Great, and then my second question on Part 2, so just a little bit more on the powering. Are you assuming a higher placebo effect with the Part 1 data out there for patients in this community, and then would enrolling, say, 120 or 150 patients, allow you to avoid a near miss?
So when looking at, our data as well as other data, we first noted from other trials that the placebo effect is generally maximal at week 12. And so in the idebenone phase 3 trial that was not successful, the modified FARS as well as the ICARS score, which is another measure of ataxia similar to modified FARS, were both improved at week 12. ICARS was almost back to baseline at week 24, and modified FARS had worsened from baseline. And so for the purposes of our modeling, we're assuming the same placebo effect. We're not assuming that it goes away at week 24. And once again, when we take a blended effect of 160 with patients with Pascavis limited, we expect the treatment effect to be somewhere around 3.5 modified FARS points. And so, with 100 patients, assuming the same variability, we can detect a difference of approximately 1.2 points. And so, there's a few layers of conservatism built into that. And that if we miss our treatment effect, but it's still approximately half or slightly less of what we observed in Part 1, the trial will be successful. There's a few other elements worth pointing out that Dr. Lynch nor I highlighted earlier. And that's that. Importantly, you know, we've learned, you know, from the KOLs who participated, you know, in the other trials, that, you know, variability upon entry into the trials has been a major reason for failure. And so, you know, we are requiring that patients have screening in day one values within 4.5 points. We're trying to detect a difference, you know, of, you know, a minimum, you know, 1.2 points. We think we'll see a difference of 3 to 4 points, which would represent, you know, 1 to 2 years of progression. We've heard that in other trials, some patients have had differences of 10-plus points coming in. And so, and that, you know, approximately 15% of patients in some other trials have had differences that are that large. And so we want to limit that, and so we're doing that by requiring patients' values to be within 4.5 points. In part one, 85% of patients had baseline measurements that were within that threshold. Secondly, as Jen Farmer, the executive director of FAIR, mentioned during discussions today, the training effect is an important reason why there is a placebo effect. And so in our trial for part two, we've added an extra element that if a patient has not done a modified FARS exam within 90 days prior to entry of the trial, there's a practice exam done as soon as they get to the clinic on the first screening day that allows the patient to get familiar with the exam, and that does not count for eligibility. The first one that will count is done later that day. And so we think with all those design elements and keeping the same eligibility criteria and then, you know, enriching for the patients that did the best, you know, gives us, you know, a very good chance of, you know, confirming the efficacy that we saw in the first part of the trial.
Great. Thank you. Congrats on the data.
Our next question comes from the line of Igor Nachimovitz from Citigroup. Your line is now open.
Yeah, hi. Hi, thanks. So Dr. David Lynch said something interesting in the talk an hour ago. He said that they did the activity test, the exercise test, and then they measured the FARS 1 hour later, and then his conclusion was that that could have potentially, you know, the fact that some of the patients with the foot deformity did the exercise test and then did the FARS test an hour later may have influenced the results. So what's the plan for the part two? Are you going to change the delta between those two measurements in any way?
Yeah. Hey, Igal, it's Colin. So thanks for the question. Dave, Dr. Lynch, as well as Jen Farmer, when I initially reviewed the data with them recently, they had a very interesting observation, which was, you know, that we did the FARS exam an hour after the exercise test may have allowed us to detect a signal. Because we had to stress patients during the exercise test, and so they went, you know, until, you know, peak exhaustion, or in the case of some of the patients with Pescavus, until, you know, they had, you know, pain and could no longer continue. And so there was probably limited ability for patients to have a placebo effect because they were so tired, and they thought that was perhaps a very important design element as to why we were able to see a signal. And so they requested that we do not change the order of the assessments for the second part of the trial. We will be, of course, changing the order, the endpoint in the statistical hierarchy, but we will be doing the exercise testing first. As far as the Pescavus, I think Dave was going between a few thoughts. You know, there are a few reasons why that could have affected the data. The most obvious one is that patients who have Pescavus have lost lateral support of their feet, and so they have a very high arch. They can have hammer toes, and you can see light underneath their feet, and so they don't have the lateral stability. And so if they're doing the bicycle test, it's hard for them to pedal because of this. Their natural inclination is for their legs to go out, not down and around. Furthermore, for the FARS exam, it's another reason why it's difficult for them to stand beyond, you know, their ataxia and loss of coordination. And so there are two related issues, but we think both are important to
is there any more standby?
Okay, thanks. And then I guess given the fact that in this patient population, at least from the digging I did, at least half the patients have this foot deformity. And so, you know, given the challenges with doing the bike, what about another approach? You know, I was wondering maybe they could have special shoes designed, for example, or just use one of those, you know, bikes that uses the arms instead of the legs to do the maximal exertion. Are those some thoughts you're considering too? So you could have a study that would enroll, you know, the whole patient population.
And we've considered a range.
I can't hear anything.
It was just not as robust. So I'm not sure if you heard me. So we considered not even including those patients in the second part of the trial, but we all thought, including the investigators and FARA, that it would be prudent to include them because they did show an improvement. It was just less robust in the patients without Pescavus. And instead of developing some new technique that we did not use in the first part of the trial, we would just do what we did, yet limit those patients and stratify by them.
Okay, so there's no... There's no alternative way to do the stress test for these patients with not using the feet?
There is, but we want to minimize the changes between this study and...
The call keeps getting cut out. I can't hear anything.
I think there's some background noise maybe from your phone, but I think Warren said that we can. There are other ways to potentially test these patients, but we have not done that yet. We don't want to inject more variability doing a new technique, and so we thought the best way to handle this would be to include them, but control for them by stratifying by that status and limiting the number of patients who come into the trial.
Okay, thanks. And then last question is, I might have missed this in the comments, but did you look at differences in target engagement of NRF2 for the patients with the Pescavus or not?
Yeah, excellent question. And there does not appear to be any difference in target engagement.
Okay, thanks very much. Sorry about the background noise.
Our next question comes from the line of Adam Walsh from Stifel. Your line is now open.
Oh, hey, thanks for fitting me back in for a couple of follow-ups. My first one is a competitor mentioned during their presentation at the day today, the patient-focused drug development thing, they mentioned that they were going to start a trial in September as well. Do you expect a competitive enrollment circumstance to evolve here, or do you expect that enrollment will be very smooth in terms of timelines?
We don't expect enrollment to be that competitive. We've been working with almost all of the FA sites that are in existence across that network, and there's a lot of enthusiasm. We've heard from the investigators. I've discussed our data with them directly just before in the past few days, and so I know there's a lot of enthusiasm because they're excited about the data. They think the drug has activity and is safe. I can't comment on the other trial, but I just know that it was a small number of patients conducted at only two sites, and so we don't think that there will be any issues for enrollment for our trial. We'll be using 12 sites globally, so two more than the first part of the trial, and we'll provide guidance on enrollment and timing once we initiate the second part of the trial.
Okay, so no guidance now on when we might see the results from part two?
Not yet. We'll guide when we start the study.
Okay, fair enough. And then one final one. Welcome to the Direct Corporation. I apologize for that. I got something going on in the background. But so just one final one. I noticed, I was really struck when they talked this morning about when they did the polling and the number of patients that are actually diagnosed below the age of 16. And I guess my question is, your inclusion criteria for Dr. Lynch's presentation suggested that the lower limit for enrollment is 16 years of age. So how do you plan to eventually access those patients with OMAV? And I did notice looking at the prior Horizon study with Actimmune in Friedrichs that the inclusion criteria went down to 10 years of age. So why 16, and is there any chance that the FDA would allow patients younger than 16 in part two, or is that something that you've already set in stone? Thank you.
The reason why we had a lower limit of 16 is we had not conducted the juvenile toxicity preclinical trials with omaveloxolone, and we don't think that this will preclude use of the drug if it's found to be safe and effective by FDA, in part because we'll have the human data. Just from our trial perspective, we don't once again want to change the patient population where we saw the signal from the first part, and so we do not plan to adjust it for the first part of the trial. And also comment that the patients who unfortunately present, you know, younger in their life often progress much more rapidly and sometimes have more comorbidities, and so it can be a more heterogeneous and variable population. And once again, we want to try to limit, you know, our trial as much as possible so that we can have a conservative design that's very sensitive. And so for those reasons, you know, we're not changing the design or the age limit for the second part of the trial, but ultimately we don't think it would preclude, you know, use, you know, in younger patients.
Great. Thanks very much. Have a great weekend.
And I'm currently
on
the question.
Great. Well, I wanted to thank everyone for joining us today. Looking forward to hearing further questions and updating you as we move forward with the program. Thanks, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in this conference. A downloadable PDF of today's presentation and an audio recording will be available shortly after this conference call on Reata's website at reatapharma.com in the Investors News section shortly after the call today. This concludes today's program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone have a great day.